I was wondering what you remember most about PA school, if there's anything that stood out for you.
Well, when I went to PA school, it was 72 to 74, and it was uncharted territory. And, you know, I remember a lot of disorganization and sort of on-the-fly kind of stuff in my particular program. And the other thing I remember is that we did get, we did have pretty high-powered faculty and courses. Mm-hmm. Most of it was taught by physicians who were, at that time, professors at Downstate in New York City, at State University of New York at Downstate. And they were, you know, they were all professors of medicine or cardiology or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they treated us pretty much like they treated medical students.
Right.
So the content was, you know, really high-powered stuff and very meaty stuff. The actual organization of the program was, you know, less than totally optimal. But, you know, we learned sort of in spite of that.
Right. And
again, this was a period where things were really undeveloped. This particular institution had gone to Duke, and they went to maybe one or two other established PA programs, but they were all sort of, you know, just flying by the seats of their pants in terms of the design of the curriculum.
So this was at SUNY?
This was at Touro College.
Oh, Touro,
in
okay.
New York.
Mm-hmm.
This was at Touro, which at that time was based in Brooklyn.
Yep. And now they've got both the New York Touro and the one on the West Coast.
And they're opening one in Las Vegas as well.
Las Vegas, Nevada? Cool.
Uh-huh, yep.
So was there anything that stood out for you that you remember most? Anything anecdotally that stood out for you? Maybe an instructor, or maybe something that you learned about yourself, or maybe something?
Well, it was a total transformation, because I was I had been an orderly in a small town in central Pennsylvania. And so for me to go to Brooklyn to learn medicine in, you know, these hospitals, the teaching hospitals, was, you know, that was quite a transformation, and it was a transformation socially and culturally, because I had never been outside of Altoona, PA. So it was growth in just about every area you can think of for me.
How old were you when you started PA school?
24.
And did you have education before that?
Yeah, I had a bachelor's degree in history from St. Francis College in Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah?
Yep. And then I worked as an orderly for 2 years.
What kind of orderly work did you do?
I was just an all-purpose orderly in an acute care hospital.
You didn't work in a specific department?
No, I did. I covered all the medical surgical floors everywhere.
Right. So how did you learn about the PA profession, and what made you want to go to PA school?
Well, there was an intern who I got to know at the Altoona Hospital, who went off to Brooklyn to do an internal medicine residency program. And it was at the institution where they were starting the PA program.
Uh-huh.
And so he sent me a letter saying, you know, check this out. And I had already checked out a number of PA programs. I applied to Hahnemann, at that time Hahnemann, but I wasn't a Vietnam military corpsman.
Right.
And at that time, that was the preferred set of qualifications.
Right.
So I, you know, went up to Brooklyn, they interviewed me, and I got in.
So what was the level of diversity in the PA school that you went to, in terms of student body?
There was about 21 students. At least 18 of them were Orthodox Jews, almost all of them male. There was a black guy, there was a Puerto Rican woman, and an Italian guy, and that was it. The majority of folks were very Orthodox Jewish men.
Is that just because geographically where the school was located?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not really familiar.
I mean, this was in the heart of Brooklyn, and Touro is a Jewish institution founded by an Orthodox Jew who's still alive.
Oh, that's right, okay.
Bernie Lander.
Right.
And so, you know, the student body tends to be predominantly Jews from Borough Park and Crown Heights, which were two neighborhoods of, you know, Orthodox Jewish enclaves.
Right.
So that was by far the majority of the class. I was the token Irish Catholic, there was a token black guy, there was a token Italian guy, and a Puerto Rican woman. Mm. And that was it.
Right. So with the
most of our instructors were Jewish, were Orthodox Jews who were professors of medicine at Downstate.
So the background in history, how did you get to wanting to go into medicine?
Well, I didn't want to be a history teacher. My mother worked at a hospital. She was an RN. She said, hey, here's an orderly job. And I started working as an orderly and liked it. And that's what got me into medicine. And I didn't have the grades to get into medical school. Looked at the PA profession. Seemed right. At that time, there was, there were five or six programs that were sort of around. Like I said, I applied to Hahnemann and a few others. But Turo worked out, and off I went to Brooklyn.
So how was your experience during your clinical rotations? Anything stand out for you?
Well, they were very high quality. I did the rotations at Mount Sinai and Montefiore, Coney Island Hospital, a number of teaching hospitals in Brooklyn and New York City, and they were extremely rich experiences. We were treated like fourth-year medical students predominantly, and there was all sorts of things that we saw, and the clinical resources were just so varied and rich. It was a wonderful experience. I thrived and loved every minute of it. And, we saw all sorts of things, all sorts of diseases and pathology, worked in the emergency room in inner city Brooklyn. It was just wonderful.
Any experience stand out for you? Any certain patient encounter or encounter with a doc or?
That was 30 years ago. I remember some of it, but.
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to switch gears here a little bit, still relating to education. If you could change anything about your PA education, what would it be?
Well, I would have probably made the program a little more structured and probably would have made it a little bit more outpatient-oriented. It was very inpatient-oriented, which
gotcha.
I liked at the time, but I didn't have enough experience in treating outpatients and sort of primary care conditions.
Okay.
Again, the program wasn't, the program was geared up basically to provide inpatient experiences all the way across the board. So almost all of my clinical rotations were done in metropolitan hospitals.
Okay. Anything in terms of the didactic curriculum or didactic experiences that you've changed?
No, that was a solid one in terms of the subject areas. And I mean, it could have been more organized, to be sure. And, a lot of times these courses were thrown together at the last minute. But, again, the content was good. We learned a lot of medicine. And, I have no regrets there. I would not, it wasn't a bad experience. It was a very positive.
Right. So at that time, that program was a bachelor's degree, correct?
Yeah, okay. That's right.
So how do you feel about the movement toward making a master's degree a requirement for PAs?
I have been for it since the movement started, and I am a big proponent of that. I think that's where it should be, and I have always thought that. I was on the... when we did that on our faculty at GW, it was 1993. I was, I think it was the right move, still do, and I was a strong proponent of it. When I was in the leadership in APAP, I testified in front of APAP saying I think that this is appropriate. And one of the reasons is that I think that the content of PA education is indeed on the graduate level. If you look at the typical curricula, or the typical workload of a senior in college in a bachelor's program, what PA students do is far above that in terms of the rigor and the content in terms of what they do. And when you look at the workplace, the level of responsibility that is put on a graduate PA is clearly mandates or indicates that education is on the graduate level. They're not functioning on a bachelor's level.
Right.
TAs are functioning on a level far higher than typical bachelor's graduate. So I think it's the appropriate level of recognition for what PAs do in the educational program and for what they're expected to do in the practice world.
When was it that you testified with APAP?
Yeah, this was a debate that occurred on their business meeting in 1999 and 2000. I've written editorials that supported the movement to the master's degree. I think if you look at other professions, there's an inevitability to it.
Right.
PTs did it, OTs do it, and now there's folks who, they're moving on to the doctoral.
Right. Like the, just saw an article on the Doctor of NP program.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So how do you feel that, where do you see the most change needed in order to make that transition happen? Is it with the didactic curriculum? Is it
the master?
Yeah.
Well, I think, I see that as a sort of a chapter that's over in to a large degree. I think of 137 programs, at least 90 now award the master's. And, I think that, PA students have voted with their selection on this. The PA students that I talk to, they all say, I wouldn't even think about a bachelor's program. I have a bachelor's. I want to go to a master's program.
Right.
I think it's sort of, move on to the next topic.
Right. I guess my question more was about, if you look at, like, a bachelor's degree program and stack it up against a master's degree program, the ones that I've looked at, a lot of the didactic is really much the same, and they have much the same clinical experience, so...
That's true. That is true.
What makes a master's degree program a master's degree program? Is it the fact that, some programs require you to write a thesis-type project, others just require you to take a couple extra courses?
I know. I'm on a group called the Graduate Education Commission, which is a committee of APAP, and we're looking just at that, trying to come up with some definitions and some statements addressing that. Because you're right, a number of programs, when they, quote, converted to the master's, just added the paper,
right,
or added a paper and a research course,
right,
and didn't change very much of anything else. And it is very difficult sometimes to tell the difference between the master's, or a bachelor's and a master's program. But then again, there are other institutions that have really done quite a good job of making a clear distinction. They've added quite a bit of additional rigor in statistics and research methods, analytic skills, interpretation of the literature,
right,
requiring people to do a paper. It varies all over the lot. But I think your statement is correct.
So who will actually, make the blessing, okay, all PAs have to have a master's degree? Is that going to come from the medical examiner's board, or what? Where does that come from?
No, it would ultimately come from the ARCPA,
okay,
the accrediting agency. Now, they sort of soft-pedaled this, essentially by sort of saying that their specific language is that PA education is at the post-baccalaureate level. Now, this is the accrediting agency where, under the same umbrella of accreditation, you have associate's degree programs, bachelor's degree programs, and master's degree programs, and a few certificate programs. So they had to be a little careful in terms of sort of coming out and making a declarative sentence,
right,
PA education should be at the master's level. But they realize that the clear trend in PA education over the last 4 or 5 years has been for institutions to award the master's degree. So that they are sort of still in the I see this as being a transition where they're just not ready to say that just yet.
Right. When do you think that
will happen? A couple years from now, I think that when 120 of the 137 programs award the master's, it will be easier for them to say PA programs should award the master's degree.
Right. So you see that happening in the next 5 years?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's inevitable.
So do you think that most programs on the whole adequately address the topics and issues that we need to learn as students to be effective PAs?
Well, that's a very broad question.
Yeah, I know.
But in the end, I think pretty much yes. I would say that, from my vantage point, it seems as though most programs who are accredited cover enough general medicine, primary care medicine, and provide enough clinical experiences that they prepare PAs appropriately and adequately.
So my next question that kind of feeds out of that is that do you think the length of PA programs is adequate? Because most programs are 24 to 27 months, but yet there are some programs that are 3 years.
I know. Well, I would answer the question yes. I would say the length is appropriate. Now, the actual mean is 26 months. People talk about, if you get programs that are 3 to 4 years, why not just go to medical school? And it does sort of defeat the purpose, in a sense, of PA training, where, one of the original sort of notions was that you train an individual in a fairly short period of time to function on a fairly high and responsible level.
Right.
I think that a number of programs would resist the temptation to go, to 3 years and beyond. I would think that the right length is probably between 2 and 2.5 years.
So how do you feel about requiring students that are in PA programs to have previous healthcare experience? And I ask you that both personally as a PA who's worked in the field and also as an educator.
Yeah, that's an interesting question and one that we debate. I talk with my students about that a lot. I think the feeling is that having healthcare experience, number one, provides students with a little bit more comfort level when they're students. But it may not be essential to producing a good PA. I've worked in a PA program where they did not accept individuals with a whole lot of healthcare experience, and I've worked in other PA programs where they do.
Right.
And the end product after 2 years out of the program is pretty much the same. Does it help while they're students? I think so. Does it help you to make decisions in the admissions process? Yes, I think so. You do want an individual who knows a little bit about the real world of healthcare,
right,
so that they know what they're getting into.
Exactly.
So I think it's some benefit. I think it provides some value. In the end, 3 years after graduation, I'm not sure that it was absolutely necessary that the person had a year as an EMT.
So lastly, about education, and I guess my question is about, as an educator from a program that's been around a while and has a lot of prestige, there's a lot of new programs emerging, and how do you feel about the growth of the education of PAs and programs that are being accredited, and are they being accredited in a way that, are they being accurately accredited?
Well, I've participated pretty extensively in the accreditation process, and I think that they do a pretty good job. And you can't discriminate on where PA programs emerge. And I think that the ARC has done a pretty good job of saying, here's the criteria to establish a PA program. And whether you're at St. Francis College in Pennsylvania, whether you're at Emory University Medical School, or whether you're at Wichita State University, or whether you're at the Pacific University, here's what you got to do to start a PA program. And if you can meet those requirements, God bless you. You're in the fold. And I think that that philosophy has been a pretty good one and has sort of fostered the development of PA programs in a lot of different kinds of institutions.
Do you feel
you
that...
know, you've got about... You,
go ahead, I
think it's a very healthy thing. I mean, well, I counted up from the chapter in our book that there's about 50 programs set in academic health centers. Most of them are medical school or medical center based.
Right.
But then there's a, you know, there's 70, 80 other programs that are in non-academic health center kind of settings. And I think that they do a fine job. And many of them are programs that I've visited. I've seen their graduates. And they do, they do wonderfully. So it shows that the job can be done in a variety of different settings using a variety of different sponsoring institutions and resources. But I think it promoted a richness within PA education.
And that was going to be my next question, is if you, was it, you felt that a student coming out of a school that was based on a medical school had any advantage over a student that came out of a program like my program that, you know, for the actual campus that I attend is a satellite campus from the, the mothership.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are people that have that bias. And if you talk with some PA educators, you know, they'll say that they think that there is a distinct difference, and they think that the only place where PA programs ought to be is in medical school settings. But there is so much evidence on the other side of that coin that shows that PAs that are trained in, you know, a lot of other different settings do just as well and are just as effective and just as knowledgeable and responsible. You know, I think of my own alma mater at St. Francis in Pennsylvania. At that time, when I went there for history, that was 66 through 70, they didn't even have a PA program. They started a PA program in 82, and I went back there on a number of occasions to give lectures and visit with the people, help them develop the program. And, you know, this is a dinky little Catholic liberal arts college in the middle of nowhere in central Pennsylvania. But God bless them, they developed a hell of a PA program. And they affiliated with Hopkins and with places in Pittsburgh and Harrisburg and Philly. And, you know, they're in the top 10 in the U.S. News and World Report rankings for PA educational programs.
Right.
It's remarkable. And there are a number of other success stories of places where, in the most unlikely of settings, PA programs have developed and thrived and produced lots of good graduates. So it's remarkable in that sense. You know, do GW graduates, are they better prepared than Essex Community College PA program graduates? I don't know. I mean, they may have a greater depth of basic science preparation. The GW Medical Library is better than the Essex Community College Library. There are certain, you know, possible advantages. Is that worth an additional $40,000 a year in tuition? I don't know. It's hard to say. I see GW graduates, you know, coming out. They get jobs for $65. Essex graduates the same way. A lot of times there's no difference in what they do. So it's, you know, I've seen both. I've seen both ends of the, all ends. Or I've seen the whole spectrum. And, I'm not sure it's setting, the sponsoring institution or the setting is really a major determinant of success. It can be done in a lot of different settings.
Okay, switching topics now, I want to talk a little bit about the physician PA team. And I was wondering if there was anything that stood out for you about some of the relationships, your first relationships that you shared with your supervising physicians.
Well, see, I went right into education.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and my first job was at Johns Hopkins University, where they had a PA program at that time. And the first job I took was a job where I had 50% clinical responsibilities in the PA, in the primary care clinic, and 50% responsibility teaching in the then Johns Hopkins program. My physician chairman was a pediatrician who, the thing that stands out for me is that this person mentored me and taught me to be a PA educator. He sent me off to get an MPH. He encouraged me to write papers. He gave me the opportunity to develop as an academic. I was still doing clinical part-time clinical practice during those years, But he basically saw me as a junior faculty member and tried to support my development to be a PA educator. I was very lucky in that regard. I mean, most of my colleagues graduated from the program and started out being clinicians.
So based on your experience as an educator and seeing students out there in their first jobs and your colleagues, what do you think are the critical steps in building trust with your supervising position?
Be honest about your capabilities and capacity. Negotiate with the physician. Be a hard worker.
How do you feel that physicians view PAs now? The profession's been around as long as it has.
I think in general there's a lot of acceptance. That's been a growth circumstance over the years within medicine, but there's still the occasional physician who doesn't want to have anything to do with PAs or doesn't see the PAs as being particularly necessary. But I think the younger generation of physicians, oftentimes trained with PAs, or they see PAs in the places that they've trained, and regard them as members of the healthcare team. It used to be that physicians were always the captain of the ship, and they were king, and that was it. But I think the younger generation of physicians and the more enlightened physicians realize that it's a team effort in healthcare, and PAs are part of the team. And the really intelligent physician should realize that the PA can help them out considerably. Not only patient care-wise and quality-wise, but economically. PA in your practice makes you a lot of money. And the effective utilization of the PA is a very savvy thing to do business-wise this day and age.
That's going to be my next question. Is that on the whole, do you feel like most PAs across the country are fully utilized in their capabilities?
I think so, yeah. There was an era, and I've seen a number of instances where PAs were exploited or PAs were not utilized to their full capability. But I don't see too much of that this day and age. I think PAs are used very much to their full capability. And the one example of that was in the days of where most states didn't have prescribing. I think that was one area where a PA was their training and knowledge was not being effectively used. But now that prescribing is no longer an issue almost anywhere, I think for the most part PAs are used as they should be used.
Have you had any experience with telemedicine so far, or any of your students?
Not a great deal of experience, no. I think that tends to be a phenomenon that you see more of in Western states and states where there's larger distances between a doctor's clinic and a satellite clinic. I don't have an extensive amount of experience with that.
Do you think that physicians during their medical school training are adequately informed about the skills and education of PAs and how to work with PAs?
Not in the typical medical school setting, no. I think that some of them learn that in residency, and I think that, but I don't think medical schools go out of their way. Certainly at GW, but GW Medical School does not go out of its way to educate GW MD students on utilization of PAs or MPs for that matter.
Okay, my next topic is specialization of PAs.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever practice in a specialization?
No.
During the
I was primary care internal medicine.
So do you think that there's going to be, like in the physician world, eventually a shortage of PAs who want to work or will work in primary care?
Yep, I do. And the numbers are already starting to show that. I think that it was either last year or the year before, the number of new graduates going into the primary care specialty keeps going down. And I think overall, there are now 52% of all PAs who are in specialty practices, and I think the number in family medicine continues to go down, and it's now like 32%. So the trends are that PAs are becoming, more and more PAs are becoming specialized and working in specialty, and that is imitative of their physician colleagues. And you know, I see it in some ways as an inevitability. It's a natural tendency in the health profession to want to specialize. The money tends to be in the specialties and subspecialties. That's where there is a great demand. And it's hard to buck these trends. As much as I would like to see more PAs going into primary care, going into rural areas, so on and so forth, the salaries, for example, in primary care specialties are far lower than they are in the surgical subspecialties. And, you know, there's a natural tendency for a lot of students who are coming out of programs, particularly having a lot of debt, to go into these lucrative specialties and subspecialties. So, I mean, I say this all with a tone of regret, because I'd like to see the profession sort of staying true to its primary care orientation, and you know, the idea that more PAs work in rural areas, medically underserved areas, than do physicians. You know, I think that was a good thing.
Right.
But the current trends would suggest that things are going in the other direction.
Yeah, that was my question. Was that does this trend kind of buck whatever it was that PAs were really supposed to be about in the first place?
Well, it's different, and, here's another part of it that's historic. The initial group of PA graduates in the 70s were mostly men, were mostly ex-Vietnam corpsmen, and they had all these skills, and they went through PA programs, and they couldn't wait to get into practice and do a lot of things on a semi-independent basis. And for them, the opportunity was primarily in family practices in rural areas and medically underserved areas and small communities. And so the initial generation of PAs, the first generation of PAs, did that to a fairly substantial degree. The subsequent generations of PAs were different. And now we have a generation of PAs that the PAs graduating are women. They do not have a large amount of healthcare experience. They're looking for different things. Their influences are different. Their lifestyles are different. And they, because of those factors, those sociocultural factors, they tend not to want to go into rural Kentucky and be a family practice PA working with Dr. Jones in a community of 20,000.
Right.
You know, the young woman graduate of the PA program, socially, that's not a good thing for her. Culturally, it's not a good thing for her. It's just a different era and a different generation. And I think that also accounts for some of these patterns that we're talking about. That original generation just had some very unique characteristics that led them to want to, and also the other thing is to prove the profession. And there was a real sense of responsibility that these people wanted to prove to the medical world that PAs were worth something. And they could do that best by going into rural areas and going into primary care.
So do you feel that PAs have a responsibility to serve in primary care for at least a required period of time after they get out of school?
Well, I don't think you can do that in this society. You don't require medical students to do it. You know, you don't require periods of social service for any health professions graduate. I don't think you can impose that.
Yeah. So do you think that this trend is going to create another health care provider shortage, much like it was in the 70s?
It could get that, you know, already the match for primary care residencies for physicians continues to go down. It could reach the there probably will come a time when people start calling attention to the fact that, hey, we don't have that many primary care physicians, primary care providers. At one time we had government programs through the Department of Health and Human Services that promoted the training and utilization of primary care providers. Those programs are drying up, going away, being slashed. At some point that will probably return as an area of policy concern.
So what areas do you see as emerging, new emerging specialties for PAs besides the ones that...
Hospitalist.
Right.
PAs working in specialties, subspecialties, and in hospital-based positions where they're replacing house staff.
What about psychiatry? There's a huge deficit of psychiatrists out there. Do you think PAs are going to be more utilized in that area?
No, not really.
No.
Now, the reason I think that there'll be less than 1% of all PAs work in psychiatry now. I think that there will continue to be some opportunities for PAs in psychiatry, and in particular, for PAs to take care of the medical needs of psychiatric patients. I think that will exist. Is it a big, giant growth area? Probably not. The reason being is that there's a lot of different kind of health providers in psychiatry. You got psychiatric nurses, you got social workers, you got psychologists. You know, there's 6 or 8 different healthcare professionals in that field, and I just think that there is a small niche for PAs, but I don't think that it's going to be gangbusters.
Okay. So besides hospitalists, what other areas do you see having a lot of growth, specialty areas?
Radiology, interventional radiology, cardiothoracic surgery, orthopedics, and emergency medicine. I think all of those will continue to be very strong areas of utilization.
Do you think that specialization requires additional training or a postgraduate residency?
It's coming to that. And, you know, that's a big debate in the profession. The AAPA says, no, we don't want this to occur. We don't want to accredit residency programs because that will limit career flexibility for PAs. And there's probably an argument to be made for that. You know, on the other hand, there's, a natural tendency for people to want to obtain advanced specialty training to sort of have a credential that says, I am good at this particular area of medicine. There's a tendency for PAs and specialties to want to have their own organizations, to get their own CMEs within that organization. In some ways, there's a sort of a natural tendency for healthcare professionals to want to do this, and it's hard to counter those. But, you know, by the same token, the academy makes a good point that if you do that, then you potentially delimit the career flexibility that PAs now have. You know, as a PA now, you can work in family medicine for 10 years, and then you can change the next week and go and work in an emergency room.
Right.
And they want to protect that sort of flexibility element, and I think it's a legitimate argument. So it's tough. I think inevitably you'll see more PA residencies. I think that the ARC will indeed eventually accredit these programs. I think that despite the Academy's objection, there will be an accreditation mechanism set up for these programs. Now, whether that will eventually close off specialties, the person's only trained in residency programs, that could happen. If it does happen, I think it's 15, 20 years down the road, and some will regard it as not a good thing.
Okay. I wanted to talk just a few minutes about autonomy of PAs.
Sure.
First off, just let me ask you, do you think that PAs enjoy the amount of autonomy that they expect when they get out of school and go into the workplace?
Absolutely. The satisfaction ratings for PAs are unbelievable. in terms of, you know, when you do surveys and ask people, you know, would you do it again? Do you like your job? Do you like your career? You know, the percentages are very high. And it's impressive for a profession that was a dependent, that is a dependent profession. I know that in the early days, people worried aloud about that. And they said, well, these people are going to get frustrated, and, you know, they're always going to be the number two person, and this is going to, you know, cause a lot of frustration on the part of these folks. It doesn't seem to have happened. And, you know, within a physician's practice, these PAs do all sorts of things and do it on a, you know, pretty autonomous basis. And, you know, I've written papers on this. I've read the sociologic literature. And when you look at job satisfaction and career satisfaction for individuals in a wide variety of professions, one of the key things is autonomy. And PAs enjoy a great deal of autonomy in terms of what they do. There's one sociologist who called it negotiated performance autonomy. And if you think about it, you know, that's kind of, that really captures it. Negotiation with the doc, you perform, you prove to the doc that you can do the job, and as a result, you're given a fair amount of autonomy in patient care, patient decision making. You know, you decide the antibiotic, you decide this, that, and the other thing. Traded in the role. It's remarkable. It, from the sociological point of view, it's a remarkable phenomenon.
So you think the satisfaction level is pretty much directly related to the great deal of autonomy that we enjoy?
I think that that's a big part of it, yeah. I mean, you practice medicine.
Right.
You're practicing medicine. And you know, you're given a good deal of responsibility and a good deal of autonomy.
So my other question related to autonomy is, in regard to the NP profession and how NPs are not required to have supervision from a physician, and you know, a lot of PAs talk about, you know, they kind of hold that ideal of working in the supervision of a physician as something that's esteemed, but yet some of the PAs that I'm encountering out in the field during my clinical rotations are seeing a lot of jobs go to NPs that could have gone to PAs if there wasn't that component of having to have physician supervision.
Well, that happens. You know, that happens. And you know, NPs have set up their profession to be on a more independent basis, you know, working under the aegis of their nursing license, and they chafe under the idea of physician supervision. We seem to thrive under the, you know, this physician connection. I know that happens. I know there's instances where NPs are preferred because they can do certain things and don't require physician supervision. But I think that overall we've gained the advances that we have because we're not threats to physicians. Whereas to some physicians, nurse practitioners are threats. The other thing is, you know, the business of independent versus dependent, in a lot of instances, it's much more, it's real on the rhetorical level, it's real on the organizational level, but in the day-to-day clinical practice level, I'm not sure that it's that big a deal. There's lots of places that use PAs and NPs interchangeably,
right,
and they're both basically supervised providers.
Right.
And this is also the era of the team, where, you know, there's PAs, there's NPs, there's PTs, there's a lot of different kind of health professionals. And, you know, this independent thing. I mean, I don't know of too many nurse practitioners that can make it economically and professionally going out and hanging out a shingle and saying, I'm an independent provider of primary care medical services. Those NPs are few and far between.
So you don't think this is a trend that's going to become, quote-unquote, a dangerous trend where there's going to be a lot of job losses to NPs?
Well, that could happen once these nurse practitioners are armed with a doctoral degree. I think, you know, there is, it's possible. And I think that there will be instances where, you know, PA jobs could be lost, or we would lose jobs in certain settings to nurse practitioners, particularly those who might have this doctoral degree. That could happen. I don't think that's going to be a major thing, but I think that in certain settings, particularly the settings in which the hiring will be not by physicians but by administrators, it could happen.
Do you mind if I take a quick break and call you right back?
Not a problem.
I need to let my dog out and run to the restroom, and I'll call you right back, and we'll finish up.
Sure, okay.
Are we doing okay with time for you?
Yeah, I can, another about 10 or 15 minutes.
Okay.
Because I have another, I have a conference call at 11.
Oh, you do, okay. If we don't finish up today, would I have the opportunity to call you again?
Yeah, if you want to do that, but why don't we set up a time when you can call me again?
Okay. Do you want to just end now for today and then resume on another day, or what would be best for you?
Yeah, why don't we end for today and finish it up in the next couple of days or something.
Okay. What's your schedule?
Would that work? Well, you could call me tomorrow morning, or you could call me Sunday morning, or you could call me Monday afternoon.
Okay. What time on Monday afternoon?
Anytime after noon, I could still do it.
Okay, I don't get out of the clinic until probably about 4 o'clock Mountain Time, so that would be 6 o'clock your time, actually. So
that would be fine. You'd call me at 6 on Monday, end of day Monday.
Great. Same phone number?
That would work. What's that?
Same phone number?
Same phone number, 443-414-3522.
Great. All right, thanks, Jim. It's a really interesting conversation. I appreciate your time, and I'll talk to you on Monday.
Okay, I look forward to it.
There's an impression, I think, that the PAs relate to their patients better and they have a better connection with patients. I'm sure you've heard, a lot of those things, and you mentioned a few. The thing I find is I think that that's largely true, but it's all anecdotal. There is really very little in the way of research or studies that confirm that.
That's
and
true.
I put these kinds of things in this category of, infamous PA myths, that we are more primary care oriented than other kinds of providers, that we go into rural areas more than other kind of providers, that, you have to be a military corpsman or an EMT, have that as a background before you be a PA. There's not a lot of hard data studies that show that any of these things are true. And I know the literature pretty well, and, unfortunately, there's not a lot of studies that have been performed recently.
Right.
And even the ones that tend to support some of these suggestions were done 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's true.
Have there been any studies that you know of that have looked at the public's perception or awareness about what a PA is and what skills we have?
Certainly not any recent ones.
Uh-huh.
There was a time when there was a lot of debate about what we should do to promote our profession. And there was actually a couple of resolutions submitted to the House of Delegates that would have directed the AAPA to spend a lot of money on ad campaigns. And it was debated and defeated. And one of the arguments was, how much would it get us if we would spend $100,000 taking out a full-page ad in the USA Today? It would be here today and gone tomorrow.
Right.
So the official position of the Academy is that we educate the public on PAs one patient at a time.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think there's still a relative lack of information that the general public has about PAs. Although, obviously with 55,000 in the workplace now, it gets better all the time because more and more people are exposed to PAs.
Right.
And most of it is, I would think, is favorable. There was one colleague of mine who was working on a PhD who actually did he went and checked out LexisNexis, mm-hmm. and ran a search of all of the articles that ever mentioned PAs, mm-hmm. and he found that, you know, the vast majority of them were positive. So, I mean, it's, you know, and he did this a year or two ago.
Okay.
And he actually published this. This was in Advance for PAs. I think it was sometime last year. The guy's named John Kavanaugh. You know, I mean, there's scattered data that support the notion that the public is familiar to some degree with PAs and are supportive. The real studies on patient acceptance, again, the ones that were very well done and done systematically with large numbers of patients, were all done in the 70s when the concept was first introduced.
Right. So historically, then, the issue of perception maybe is not so much an issue today as it was in the 70s
and 80s. I don't think it's nearly as much as it was, no. It's getting better. It's getting better.
Right. On the topic of history of the PA profession, I'm wondering about what you feel like has shaped our profession so far and what you feel like will shape it in the next 20 years.
Boy, that's a hard one, because there's a lot of things that shape that shape the profession.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, like, in terms of the history so far, it's mm-hmm. been things like, of course, the military and managed care.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about so much managed care. There's a fairly small percentage of PAs in managed care. If you actually look at the numbers, I think, you know, less than 6 or 7% of PAs work in HMOs and managed care systems. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly small percentage. The military, without doubt. Physicians and physician acceptance, and this group of physicians that started the profession and supported the profession, that was an important factor. Hang on one second.
Okay, go ahead.
Hello? I'm on the other line with this
So, you know, it's very complex, I think, to answer the question simply and quickly, what were the influences? What I was going to say is also, you know, the state laws, the fact that the AMA got behind the profession and said to state medical boards, it's okay to pass laws to allow PAs to work. I think that was a big step. Getting Medicare reimbursement was another big step. Commissioning of PAs by the military branches, that was big. You know, all these things that indicate acceptance by large healthcare institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Medicare in 1986 was a biggie. What'll shape it in the future? Number one, if PAs are continue to be willing to remain in a dependent practice role, if they don't get too greedy in terms of the amount of money that they want, if they continue to go at least to some extent in primary care and rural areas, if they stay true to those sort of roots, at least acceptable percentages. It's hard, though. You know, more and more want to be specialty in specialties. I think those are big factors.
Okay. How do you feel PAs on an international scale will influence the profession?
Will it influence the PA profession in the United States? Not much. I don't think. You know, I've been to three different countries now on PA consults, Great Britain, Taiwan, and the Netherlands, and Canada for that matter. Mm-hmm. And I think these countries are going to fashion the PA role to suit their country's health system. Mm-hmm. And they may end up, and I know this is certainly true in the Netherlands, you know, those PAs are going to end up being a little different kind of PAs than the PAs that we see in the United States. So I don't think that the concept in other countries is going to influence the way we use PAs that much here. Because, you know, the PA is sort of shaped and the role is very much influenced by physicians and the way that the health system uses them. And each country's healthcare system is different. The United States is very different from a number of these countries that I just mentioned. But I don't see that being such a thing.
I know that you've worked some with development in the Netherlands with that PA program over there.
Yep.
Have they used the American PA model to...
See, what I think these countries are doing is that they look at the overall concept, and then they look at the way that the concept has developed and the way that PAs are utilized in the United States, and then they adapt that to their system. And, you know, like they may take 60% of it, they take certain aspects of it. Do these people function in fairly similar ways, U.S. versus other countries? Yes, but there are differences. And so I think that because they have to adapt them for use in their country's healthcare system. Because the systems are very different. Netherlands is a very, very different healthcare system, and so is Great Britain. What I think that they do is they take the PA concept, and by concept I mean, you know, the whole thing in a very broad meaning, and fashion it to their healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
And it may or may not, in the end up looking like American PA.
Right.
Probably not.
In terms of diversity within the profession, how have you seen that change over the years in terms of both student population and the workforce?
Well, in terms of, I'll give it a grade on a scale of 10 in different categories. In terms of overall recruiting minorities and people of various diverse backgrounds into PA programs, I would say that it's 8 on a scale of 10. In terms of retaining those people to graduate, 7 on a scale of 10. In terms of overall numbers within the profession, 6 on a scale of 10. I don't think that we do in the profession, you know, a tremendous job of promoting racial and ethnic diversity.
Mm-hmm.
It's really got to start at the programs. And some programs do a very good job. But, you know, if you look at the overall percentages, the profession's still 88% white.
Right.
So, you know, I think that you know, would I say that we're doing a fantastic job in that department? The numbers would suggest not.
I had an interview on Friday with Ruth Ballwig, and we were talking about the requirement for a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And she spoke of, and I'm just kind of wondering what you think about this, she spoke of how moving toward that requirement could truly limit the amount of diversity that we currently have in the profession, and that there are people in rural areas that, you know, maybe 2 hours away from a four-year university, and just getting a bachelor's degree and a PA certification is monumental, much less, you know, getting a bachelor's degree and then going on to something like a master's track program. What do you think about that?
Well, let me answer it this way. Ruth and I have been on the opposite end of this debate for a number of years, and she's a dear friend and a good colleague. And I know that that has been the concern. You know, she has been opposed to moving toward the master's.
Right.
And I've been a proponent.
Right.
I guess what I would say to my dear friend is, anecdotally, while that may be true in some instances, I don't see much data that supports that. Even the community college programs, I live in Maryland. There's two community college-based PA programs in Maryland, and they do a fine job, and both of them have arranged to award the master's degree. So I think it's possible for PA programs to be able to maintain sort of open doors to recruit, individuals from economically disadvantaged backgrounds, mm-hmm. racial and ethnic diversity backgrounds, and still award the master's degree. Mm-hmm. I think hers is kind of an old argument that is not particularly supported by very much data. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that, the PA educational community and students have already voted by the choices that they've made. We effectively are at the master's degree. The master's degree is the current, pretty much de facto standard for PA education. Mm-hmm. Whether you like it or not, or whether it impacts on diversity in recruitment, irregardless, it is now de facto the standard.
Mm-hmm. So where do you think that educators, program directors can influence diversity for the positive?
Well, it has to come in their admissions and recruitment processes. They just have to make a commitment to do it and to build that into recruitment and admissions. In some instance, for example, at our place at GW, for a long time we've given extra points in our equation to people with various types of disadvantaged backgrounds, mm-hmm. So that we can balance our class and select individuals to balance the class. We're committed to doing that. APAP supported affirmative action. APAP supported the University of Michigan decision 2 years ago to support that affirmative action and decision making, so that the classes resemble the population in general. And I think that's what you have to do.
So, in your experience as a educator and your involvement in recruitment of students and choosing students for acceptance into programs, what minorities have you really, has the program that you're worked with really looked at?
Looked at or tried to recruit?
Tried to recruit.
African Americans, especially African American males. They're as rare as hen's teeth, qualified African American males. If you can find them, we want to know about them. There's just not that many around that are qualified.
I'm just curious. I hear minorities being discussed in terms of the traditional kind of minorities in terms of ethnic and cultural background, but I rarely ever hear people talk about maybe recruiting a gay or lesbian student. And I wonder if programs ever really think about that, or if it's not really considered a minority recruitment problem.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's classified in that way. I think that different programs or different programs may differ in their approach to recruiting gay and lesbians. I think it depends on whether or not those people want to indicate that.
Self-identify, yeah.
I think that's a big factor. At the very beginning of such a prospect is whether or not those, because I don't think it's legal to ask that question on an application.
Right.
So, that would hinder that kind of promoting that kind of policy.
Right. So, anecdotally, can you think of, and all the students that you've met and worked with, can you think of a student who truly came from a diverse background that you saw really kind of overcame challenges and stood out in your mind?
Lots of them. lots of them. Lots of them. Economically disadvantaged, racially, culturally. I've been in PA education for 30 years, and I've seen plenty who come in and who have been transformed in 2 years into really outstanding healthcare professionals. I've seen. I remember one kid that came out of the hills of West Virginia. He was, he was right up in there with the kid in Deliverance. He was damn near catatonic when he came into the PA program. And 2 years, and he's out there delivering healthcare. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And there's, there's too numerous to count transformations.
Right.
Many, many of them. You talk about gay and lesbians. We accept a number of the persons who are gay and lesbians in our program, in part because we're in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And, we get a number of applications, and, sometimes those folks really, they've come out of the closet, they've gone into work in HIV and AIDS clinics, mm-hmm. or gay and lesbian healthcare clinics in the district, and really have developed and, become more comfortable with their own, sexual identity, become, accomplished professionals, and there's a whole, in every way you can think of.
I hear the term PAs as agents of change a lot, and I wonder, what do you feel it means to be an agent of change in a PA?
Well, I guess that means proselytizing for the profession. Or for improvement in the healthcare system that includes more recognition of PAs and what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what that means. And I think that there are PAs that do that, and I think that they do that well.
Who do you think some of the key change agents have been for us as a profession?
People?
Yeah.
Well, I think Ruth has been a change agent. She's certainly promoted the use of PAs in rural and medically underserved areas, particularly rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
Rod Hooker has been one in the area of research. There have been a number of PAs that have transformed the organization,
mm-hmm.
Provided leadership within the organization. Glenn Combs, Marshall Sinback. That's a hard question to answer. There's a lot of good ones.
Yeah. So, just to finish up, I wanted to ask just a few questions about politics.
Sure.
What organizations do you think have politically shaped our profession? And I know that the AAPA was it originally kind of crafted to look like structurally the family practice, the American Association of Family Practitioners?
Kinda, yeah. I would say that's true. I think that they're most influenced by other medical organizations, mm-hmm. particularly physician organizations. To some extent, many PA programs have been shaped by federal government, by the grants program.
Mm-hmm.
Because the grant, in order to get a federal grant, they lay out certain initiatives and incentives and requirements. When you get federal money, there's always strings, and so some of those have shaped the development of PA programs. Again, most of them in terms of, promoting the deployment of graduates into rural and medically underserved areas.
So politically, what do you think was the key issue that we faced, say, 20 years ago?
Medicare, getting Medicare reimbursement.
And how about what we face today?
Politically?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess one of the things that's a kind of a minor thing, not minor, one of the things the threat to not have any more federal funding for PA education. That's, I think it's likely that we will lose federal money in support of PA education.
Mm-hmm.
But health professions, educational assistance seems to be a thing of the past for a lot of different professions, you know, except physicians. I don't know. In terms of what the politics. I think it's a time when PAs are okay in that department. I don't know what the federal government could do for us, even if they wanted to.
Okay.
I mean, we certainly have a great deal of acceptance, and we're doing just fine.
To wrap things up, I just kind of wanted to ask you a couple of esoteric, if you will, questions.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder what, for you, has been the best part about being a physician assistant. I know you've worked mostly as an educator, so that's going to influence what your answer is. But
well, I mean, it's just a wonderful career. I was very lucky I got in on it at the beginning, and I've seen it grow, and I've been a part of it, and it's been the best I could imagine. Far exceeded my expectations. I've been able to be a part of medicine and to teach students for 30 years. It's been just unbelievably rewarding.
What's been the most difficult or challenging part of being a PA?
Acceptance by physicians and patients. I think is the most. No matter where you are, whether you're a clinical PA or education or whatever.
And looking back, what's been the most key event for you in your career? Has it been
getting
efficient?
my first job at Johns Hopkins.
Okay.
That was my big break. I was hired right out of the PA program to work at Johns Hopkins, and that was by far the biggest event that affected me in my career.
See, what are your credentials, the things that you put at the end of your name when you
MPH, in? MPH, PAC.
Okay. Well, I think that wraps it up. I'm sure when I go back and retype some of my notes here, I might have some questions for you, and I can just send those to you via email.
Okay.